This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 12th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 236 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up in today's programme, we delve into one of America's biggest corporate scandals, the conviction of Tyco International CEO Dennis Kozlowski, with author Catherine Neal, who believes his claims of innocence.
I was a guy sitting in a courtroom who made $100 million a year, and I think a juror sitting there just would have to say, all that money, he must have done something wrong. I think it's as simple as that.
Plus, we meet a man who's been battling anxiety since he was a child and yet has managed to become one of the most important persons in American media. Scott Stossel, editor of The Atlantic, will be with us to discuss his new book, My Age of Anxiety.
And we'll dissect The Anatomy of a Suit, a new exhibition at the Museum of London with the museum's fashion curator, Timothy Long.
All that, plus Monocle's Tom Edwards will be here for a look at some of the big stories next week, and we'll play you a great track too. Lots to get through today on episode 236 of the Monocle Weekly. Happy New Year, Andrew.
Happy New Year to you as well.
It's not too late to say it, is it?
No, not at all.
In Russia, it's not even happened yet, or China.
I interviewed Guy Delaunay in Serbia this week. They were the same. They're Orthodox. They were just beginning to settle down for their Christmas dinner when I spoke to him 2 days ago.
hope you didn't have him for long on the phone.
They have a proper chocolate log as well. No, not a proper chocolate log. They have a Yule log, rather. They do. They
go and a proper traditional. I thought
I've always thought of a Yule log as being like a chocolate log,
right? Yeah.
But in fact, they get a log.
They do. They actually get a log.
Yeah, it's not as tasty, but they do go to the forest and collect them.
I hope they don't. I hope it's a candlelit ceremony. I hope they don't get the two confused. It could do terrible damage to your teeth on a piece of freshly felled oak.
Unless you're a beaver.
Talking of animals.
Yes.
The man in our clip at the top of the show there.
Yes.
Does it remind you of any animated animal? Cartoon?
I know who you think.
Animated. I'm thinking Jim Henson. I'm thinking
Fozzie Bear.
Right. We were talking about that before the music cut in and we had to realise we were presenting the programme. But that promises to be quite an interesting thing, right? I think a big business story, starting as we mean to go on the Monocle Weekly, right, Andrew?
Are you going to ask the questions in the style of Miss Piggy?
I will, and if I don't get the answers I want, I'll hit them in my handbag.
Talking of Miss Piggy.
Yeah.
Should we pause now and have Tom Edwards?
Bringing you all the news you need. It's Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards.
Wow. Welcome to the show, Tom. That was quite a lean, mean intro for you today.
I like it, but it has a kind of an orchestral quality to it.
A bit of Star Wars.
I think it's a bit of a sort of Russian flavour, doesn't it, or something? I don't know.
It could be a bit of, possibly. It's a bit of Commander Burano, whatever it is.
Yeah. Rimsky, Commander Burano.
you know what I mean, Rimsky-Korsakov.
Yeah,
Carmina Burana.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm going Commander Burana.
That's why they never shoot me from the waist down.
Anyway, this is the first of our look-aheads over the news for the week with Mr. Tom Edwards. Where are we going to start this year and this week?
Well, I actually thought we'd do a little bit of a US special, a couple of interesting stories this week. So I thought we'd kind of focus in on the US. Maybe that'll be, you know, a theme, not the US each week, but maybe a bit of geographical themes thrown in there.
Oh, yeah?
To freshen things up. Why not?
Why not?
Maybe it won't be.
Okay.
Just keep you on your toes a little bit.
You've picked a big one to go with first then, keeping it easy for yourself.
Exactly. You've got to make it easy, Andrew. I don't want to overexert myself at the start.
Do you want to rustle your paper a bit more as well?
How about, so we'll start in Detroit. Tomorrow, North American International Auto Show kicks off. Always very interesting, I think, to see the balance between, you know, green technology, electric vehicles, this kind of thing, and how some of these big old titans, especially in the US, react to that kind of thing, how they watch the marketplace changing. And just see how Detroit reacts, because we've talked a lot on Monocle 24 about the problems the city's faced, and yet this is a really prestige event. lots of international focus, and can it give a, you know, another shot in the arm to the local auto industry?
But the American car industry has done well in recent years, and it is a kind of a slight bright spot, isn't it, for Detroit, when you see so many things going wrong for the city and them declaring bankruptcy, that actually many of the car companies have been taking on more employees and giving you extra work hours and things. So should it be a positive event, do you think?
I think it will be, and I think you're exactly right, and it goes almost beyond the car industry. It talks about old industry altogether, you know, proper ways of making things. I think a lot of traditional kind of makers now, you know, it's in the US and elsewhere, look to Detroit. They understand its value, you know, what the city means in terms of manufacturing. And I think hopefully they'll be able to build on that. I know a lot of the sort of, well, the domestic car producers, as you said, have actually not been doing too badly, are pretty optimistic about the next few months. So.
Good. And the next on your theme show?
Well, so the next day, there was quite a lot of controversy last week about this. Robert Gates, the former US Defense Secretary, he's publishing his memoir, Duty, next week. And we talked a little bit about this on Market 24. A few leaks have come out, some of the things he said. He's basically painted the, you know, different stages in the Obama administration, particularly obviously with regards to Afghanistan, in quite a different light. They've always been fairly cagey about revealing the sorts of discussions that went on, what Obama's attitude towards Afghanistan was. And Bob Gates, this book could be potentially quite damaging. I said a lot of the worst stuff is already out there. It's interesting that the way that he's talking about it. He's talked about Obama being skeptical to the point of being convinced outright that their whole strategy would fail in Afghanistan. He talks about Obama's relationships with both Hamid Karzai and with people like General Petraeus and how frosty and difficult they were. And it's just sort of further setback to Obama if he's still even thinking about trying to make his second term a success as a sort of international statesman character. Bob Gates has maybe dealt him a bit of a sideways blow with this one.
A sidewinder.
Yeah, it could be, exactly. It's just interesting. There's other things that Gates said, like he talks about Congress, and he says, when you're talking to the people in Congress behind closed doors, it was always very amicable, very sensible. But as soon as they go into open hearing, and he says something like, when the little red light comes on top of a television camera, it's like the effect of a full moon on a werewolf.
That's a great which is, quote.
But again, I mean, he's going both barrels for everyone all That's across Capitol good. Hill. So it'll be interesting to see how everyone reacts when all of the sort of nitty-gritty bits are exposed next week.
It might actually be one of those political biographies that you read.
Exactly, one of the rare ones. It is about 700 pages, so maybe it's better just to wait until someone's harvested out all the very best bits, like the werewolf quotes. Maybe they've done it already.
I know, that sounds good.
There's
doesn't
no
it?
Need now. I've probably given you the highlights.
What's up next?
Well, the following day, I mean, they should have got their act together by now. Technically, there's still room for them to shut down government again next week on Wednesday. They're not going to let it happen again, are they? I don't think they will. They've been battling all of this week just gone, and most of the sort of I's dotted and T's crossed to avoid that happening. But it's still kind of amazing that they can let, you know, political sort of infighting and these fractures over the same old issues. It's about, you know, military spending, healthcare spending, these same sticking points, and they're still willing to kind of sail really close to the wind. But they should avoid it. But technically, Wednesday would be the day for another US shutdown. I don't think it will happen, but it's worth watching in case some of these, you know, extreme elements at either side decide to try and...
Well, with tough weather, hardly anyone's been able to go to work anyway, so you probably wouldn't notice the difference.
Well, exactly. It's probably been in partial shutdown. I mean, that is... I do wonder whether that kind of thing does actually have an impact, because it's got to freeze out people's... the sort of rancour, hasn't it, I think, when it's... When
people
it,
become
maybe,
more...
Maybe makes it worse.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know. I think people come together, don't they, when things are like that? They kind of... There's more of a community feel. You're not so... kind of split, are you?
You'd feel, yeah, I think you'd feel the pressure, and you can kind of add more woes to America's kind of day. Oh, look at you moving your papers really gently now. Well, first of all, you came here like some old bag lady, kind of like screwing up papers.
So Miss Piggy, a bag lady, kind of just noting all these ones down for my HR appeal that will be happening at some stage.
And now he's moving them around with like the gentleness of a Japanese flower arranger.
I do try.
Speak to the ombudsman. I was wondering with that last one what was going to be shut down, and then I forgot we're on an American tip today, aren't we?
Exactly. So the whole of America is basically what might be. A bit alarming.
Yeah, that's pretty full on.
But I think one thing that will keep, you know, the lights of America always bright is, you know, movies.
We're really
kind of full moon for the howlings that takes place on Capitol Hill.
The werewolf watchers.
But it's kind of movie season, and obviously it's the Golden Globes tonight. Very exciting to find out who's won. We know a couple of the winners, like Woody Allen is going to be recognised for his contribution to cinema throughout what kind of four, probably yeah. five decades yeah. now. He'll be winning the Cecil B. DeMille Award. You've got Sundance, though, happening. That starts on Thursday. You know, about the background, really interesting, more of this kind of independent thing. But there's so many award seasons coming up. It's always great for movie watchers. The Screen Actors Guild, I think, is next Saturday as well. And it's interesting to see some of the other previews. We're talking about US politics. The Mitt Romney documentary. That's going to be at Sundance, amongst other things. I would think that would be fairly intriguing. Yeah. But loads of great, you know, independent movie. But big budget stuff, indie. It's a really exciting few weeks for movie buffs. It even draws in people who maybe aren't such movie fans, I think.
Just in my experience, Sundance, the Sundance Film Festival, was a great place to do handbrake turns on ice in a 4x4 vehicle.
On purpose.
Is that what happened to you?
Yeah. I had to stop in a hurry. Quite a few times. It's brilliant fun.
Can we ask what was going on? Or?
It was just work. But there's no extraneous expense claim. It was just for fun.
Okay.
Anyway, let's not go into that.
That's how they roll in Utah, is it?
That's how they love to roll in Utah. Yeah. Tom, I loved your thing. Maybe we'll spruce it up. I think we should have the same music on the way out for you, Tom, because it was such a U.S. It sort of had a martial quality. It's sort of almost like a Stars and Stripes
quality. I'll be happy to sashay out to that.
Tom Edwards, thank you very much for your U.S.-themed news look ahead.
Bringing you all the news you need, it's Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards.
You may not remember his name, but you've probably heard about Dennis Kozlowski, the former CEO of Tyco International. He's famous for being the guy who bought a $6,000 shower curtain, or alternatively the one who threw a $2 million birthday bash with scantily clad men and women and a vodka urinating ice sculpture of Michelangelo's David. The theme was Roman orgy, in case you're wondering.
I always wondered where Rob got the idea for his birthday party. But anyway, in 2005, Kozlowski was convicted by the Manhattan Supreme Court on multiple counts of grand larceny, conspiracy, falsifying business records and securities fraud. And yet, the question of whether he was actually guilty has remained a thorny one throughout his jail term. Now, as he prepares for release on January the 17th after 8.5 years behind bars, Kozlowski continues to claim his innocence.
Our next guest, Catherine Neal, teaches business ethics and business law at Northern Kentucky University. She's dug into the Tyco scandal, sat down with Kozlowski himself, and come to the conclusion that the CEO turned convict was indeed not a thief. In her book, Taking Down the Lion, The Triumphant Rise and Tragic Fall of Tyco's Dennis Kozlowski, she explains that his conviction was a case of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And Catherine joins us from our New York bureau now. Welcome to The Weekly, Catherine.
Thanks, Rob.
Now, this is a complicated case, but it's also a good old yarn, isn't it? Obviously, you spent quite a lot of time with Kozlowski to write this book. What was his initial reaction to you wanting to right his wrongs, or at least write his story?
When I first contacted Kozlowski, he was in a prison in upstate New York. He didn't know me. I didn't know him. I initially just wrote a letter to him in the prison. I teach business ethics, and every semester I brought up the Tyco scandal and Kozlowski's conviction during my classes, but something just never added up for me, looking at the facts that I had available to me. So in what was a pretty random act, I just wrote a letter to him one day at an address that I wasn't even certain would get to him. And about 3 weeks after I sent my letter, I received a handwritten letter in response from him from prison. And he stated his willingness to answer any questions that I might have. So I started corresponding with him, had no thoughts of writing a book at this point. I just was trying to figure out what happened that sent him to, a serious prison sentence in a New York State prison, which is tough, and eventually we wrote, and then I started visiting him at the prison to interview him, and it dug deeper and deeper into this case, and the more I looked into it, the more confused I got. So it just evolved into eventually the book that I just wrote.
And you come to the conclusion, is it fair to say that you feel that he should not have been convicted? Because not only did he get convicted, I think he said in his darkest moment he thought that perhaps he would get 5 years in jail, and he served well over 8. and he had a huge number of offences that were running concurrently, convictions rather. Is your feeling that he was, as we said in the introduction, just the wrong man in the wrong place at the wrong time?
That's the opinion I came to after, and honestly, I've looked at this case so closely, I don't think anyone spent the time with it that I have. I think I know more about it than even Kozlowski himself. And that's my conclusion. I just don't see nearly enough evidence to support criminal convictions in this case. You know, at worst, he perhaps made some bad business decisions. He made some decisions that the board of directors of Tyco at that time didn't agree with. And it was immediately post Enron and WorldCom, which here in the U.S. was, you know, this huge wave of corporate scandals and record-setting bankruptcies. And, you know, the public was outraged and prosecutors were looking for bad guys on Wall Street. You know, they were looking for, corporate executives who were abusing their power. And I think Kozlowski was really high profile. He was one of the most highly paid executives in the world at that time. And so he was a prime target. And some of the decisions he had made over the years and the way that Tyco operated left him vulnerable to attack. And, you know, so I think that in this case, there wasn't criminal activity, but prosecutors were overly aggressive at that time, and it ended up putting him in jail, you know? And he was, you know, Robert Morgenthau, who was the Manhattan prosecutor for decades, and I spoke to him, and he said, you know, he wanted to send a message, and I guess he certainly did by putting someone like Dennis Kozlowski in prison and an extremely long prison sentence. And yeah, Kozlowski said, you know, he was shocked when the guilty verdicts came in, and I think equally shocked when the sentence came down. You know, he did not expect anywhere near the sentence that was imposed. It was 8 1/3 to 25 years. You know, that's, in the United States, that's a longer sentence than murderers and rapists and child molesters. So, you know, he was shocked by it.
You mentioned the Manhattan District Attorney, Robert Morgenthau. How much of it was down to him? I mean, it's obviously, you might say that the punishment didn't fit the crime, Catherine. Was there any aspect of this of who benefits? You know, whether having a famous businessman behind bars looks to have ticked a sort of corporate box, a keeping corporations in check box. But he also employed 250,000 people, didn't he? What happens? Is there an idea, do you think, of trying to balance the pluses and the minuses?
It is. It's tough. It's, you know, a prosecutor has a lot of power, a lot of power. And just suggesting that someone is a criminal has a huge ripple effect. You know, if you look at the cost of prosecuting Dennis Kozlowski and imprisoning him, the least of it is the cost of the trials and the, you know, and keeping him in prison in the swanky quarters that he had in the state prison. That's the least of it. The cost to the corporation, to employees, to suppliers, to business partners, you know, that ripple effect is it's almost hard to calculate the billions of dollars that this cost. You know, the negative reaction of the market to the CEO being accused and then convicted of crimes. It is costly. And you look at this perspective of does it do more harm than good? Prosecutors really need to think about that balance. You know, that power is like, does throwing him in prison do more harm than good? And in this case, I think that's true.
Catherine, he comes out in but a few days' time. What next for the man? You know, is there a chance of him finding redemption? You know, America's actually quite good at forgiving people who have done their time behind bars if they come out with the right attitude. Do you think we will see him back again in the business world?
Well, he'll never, ever be a leader or a director of a publicly traded corporation here. He's restricted from doing that. But beyond that, yeah, I think that he will. I mean, he's got some tremendous business skills. He's got, you know, a mind for business strategy like I've never seen. So, you know, I hope that he can use his skills to some good. And I'm sure he will. I'm sure he'll find something to do that's productive and certainly more productive than he's been able to do for the past decade. Whether he'll be forgiven by American public, I hope so. I hope that they're as forgiving of him as they are of celebrities who, you know, find themselves behind bars and then redeem themselves. You know, people still have a real gut negative reaction to him, which is surprising to me, you know, and I've experienced it myself just in writing this book, that a lot of people just want him to be a bad guy. You know, they want to him to be the face of, you know, evil corporate America. And I hope that he's able to shake that off and, you know, move on with his life. So we'll see.
Do you think he could teach business ethics at Northern Kentucky University?
Yeah. I think, well,
that would be a shock appointment.
That would, you know, Dennis Kozlowski teaching business ethics would be, that'd be ironic, wouldn't it? But yeah, I have to say, though, he is, as far as what I can give my students, I've learned so much from him in this case that, you know, they certainly benefit from his experience. You know, I hope that none of them ever come close to going to prison because, you know, we've looked at him so closely.
Okay, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly. That was Catherine Neal, author of Taking Down the Lion. All right, let's have a track now. I played this on this week's Culture Show as one of the things to look forward to next year, an artist to watch maybe for 2014. This is Asaf Avidan, and the track is called Different Pulses.
My life is like a
That was Different Pulses by Asaf Avidan. Keep an eye out for his name this year in 2014. Coming up next, we're going to be speaking about the age of anxiety.
In 2014, the Foreign Desk is coming to Monocle 24. Interviews with presidents and prime ministers, reports from the front line, the debates, the arguments, the analysis on the world's most important stories.
There are two conventional wisdoms in Europe at the moment. The first is that the far right will dominate and be very successful at the European elections, and the second is that the far right is on the rise across Europe generally. We need to correct those two assumptions.
My hope would be that the new government in China feels sufficiently secure next year that they can ease up a little bit on the rather worrisome repressive tendencies.
Every Saturday at 12 noon in London and available for download all week on monocle.com, iTunes and SoundCloud.
This is a challenge to give them the knowledge, to give them the hope for the future that they could reintegrate into society, believe that they can get a job, get them to decouple from criminal activities, and we have more to do when it comes to these matters.
I'm Steve Bloomfield. This is The Foreign Desk. Join us from Saturday, the 11th of January.
Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck. Now, forgive me if I sound rude, but Scott Stossel, the editor of The Atlantic in the US, is a quivering, quaking, neurotic wreck. I'm not the one who says it. He writes it himself in his new book, My Age of Anxiety.
Drawing on his own battle with panic and fear, Stossel analyses the history of a condition he's been aware of since he was first evaluated at a mental hospital at the age of 10. From Freud to Charles Darwin, the book looks at the efforts of philosophers, writers, scientists and artists to understand what anxiety is exactly. And Scott joins us now, live from the Atlantic's newsroom in New York. Scott, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, the nature of anxiety, I guess that, you know, when you first think of that word, we all get slightly anxious about things, and you don't realise how debilitating it can be and how kind of paralysing it can be for some people until you kind of crack open your book. Could you just tell us a little bit about your relationship, you know, with this thing, anxiety?
Well, sure, I'm happy to, and thank you for having me on the programme. Anxiety itself is actually, some modicum of it is actually useful. It's an evolutionary adaptation without which we wouldn't have survived as a species as long as we have, because you weren't, if you're not prudent about avoiding dangerous risks, we would, you know, frolic on the edge of cliffs and take, you know, walk into lion and tiger cages and get eaten. The problem for folks like me who have clinical levels of anxiety is that it can become debilitating. Both the physical symptoms, the, you know, sweating and shaking and trembling and gastric distress, and the cognitive symptoms where your ability to think clearly and you sort of obsess about minor concerns or worry about fears, you worry about legitimate fears, but to an irrational degree, or you worry about things that are not a rational threat, and it can start to impede your daily life and really constrain your existence.
And Scott, tell me, I know the book it begins with the example of your own wedding where you were pouring with sweat and slightly panicked by everything that was going on. But then a long way through the book, your wife does point out that without it, maybe you might just be a kind of regular jerk, as it were. So she's kind of keen that you have this part of your personality as well. Just tell me that part of it, So obviously it's something you've learned to kind of, use and live with, because you are the editor of The Atlantic. So you've managed to ride your fears in some way.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I have obviously struggled with. I'm 44 years old now, and I've struggled with it since I was probably 2 to some degree, and acutely at times since I was maybe 10 or 11. But I have tried, I talk in the book about the vast panoply of therapies, pharmacological, talk therapy, devices, hypnotism, crazy new age things, yoga, meditation. And many of those things can help significantly take the edge off. And at various times, various of those remedies have worked a little bit. But fundamentally, as my wife notes, it's sort of woven into the whole of my personality and my temperament. And it's not something that I can, necessarily hope to be completely cured of. So writing this book has been partly a process of trying to come to terms with it, resigning myself to it, but also coming to embrace some of the positive aspects that may be associated with it. For instance, people who have acute anxiety are, you may be better at anticipating danger. I've talked to a lot of therapists who say they have clients who are lawyers, and they're very effective lawyers, because what you want in a lawyer is somebody who is worried about everything and anticipating every possible bad eventuality or outcome and preparing for them. Same thing in a financial advisor. You don't want a financial advisor who's not anxious at all because he's liable to lose all of your money. So there's ways in which, and studies have shown this, that anxiety can be tied to conscientiousness, to motivation. And, there are these famous studies from 100 years ago by a couple of Harvard primatologists that they worked out something called the Yerkes-Dodson scale, which shows that basically it's sort of the Goldilocks theory of anxiety. If you have too much, you'll be debilitated because you won't be able to think straight or perform optimally. But if you have too little anxiety, your adrenaline won't be pumping, you won't be motivated, your physiology won't sort of be activated in a way that makes you perform at an optimal level. So some degree of anxiety is definitely adaptive and useful, but that's stipulating that it's not severe to the point of being crippling, as it is for many millions of people in the US and the UK and all around the world.
And just within the American universe, Scott, there's an interesting idea of anxiety versus being able to admit to anxiety. And then the whole idea of self-deprecation not being a huge American trait. I know that we're maybe talking about a bi-coastal America here. But do you know what I mean? How anxiety sits with the idea of self-deprecation?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I think that maybe the British have a more, you both have the stiff upper lip, but also the self-deprecation and the wry humor. Whereas we Americans have the braggadocio and the loudness. And I do think that all throughout the industrialized or post-industrialized West, there's increasing pressure on everyone to build their own brand and to have a public persona and have it projected across social media and all this. And that can be hugely anxiety producing too, because you often end up having to kind of maintain multiple public personas that may feel somewhat at odds with your internal sense of self. And this is what one therapist I talked to calls impression management. And when you're having to deal with impression management, which conveying a view of yourself that is not you're projecting one of that to other people that doesn't feel true to yourself, it can be very stressful, because you feel like if you drop the mask, you'll be exposed as a fraud or as not the person everyone thought you to be. And I think that's probably maybe more pronounced here in the U.S., but I'm sure Brits deal with it too.
I wondered also, it seems from what you've been saying, the geographical split and maybe the social economic split is I mean, obviously anxiety is very real for its sufferers, but is it a disease of the first world, of the luxurious?
I mean, I do talk about that in the book, and it's a legitimate question whether, you know, is anxiety a problem that you wrestle with when you have the luxury of not having to deal with real things to be afraid of. Mm. And there's a whole theory that was sort of developed in the 1950s by a bunch of sociologists that, you know, for instance, if you look at the Middle Ages, in the Middle Ages, you had a lot more to be afraid of. You know, you were probably going to, you know, develop pellagra and rickets. You were much more likely to be, you know, set upon by bands of roving bandits. And yet there's a good argument that you were less anxious because you had much less free choice and less free time to be anxious. You were probably going to die at a young age and you thought you were going to be doomed to eternal damnation because of your religious beliefs. But at least, you know, you were born into the role you were going to inhabit. So life was hard. It probably was miserable in a lot of ways, but you weren't worrying about which of the 37 kinds of breakfast cereal to buy in the grocery store. And that's a mundane thing, but you also weren't having to worry about, well, should I be a doctor or a lawyer? Should I go to college? Should I be a stay-at-home mom? What personal style should I adopt? Those were just not things that you had to think about. So obviously the advance of material well-being and particularly political freedom and social freedom to choose your lifestyle is a net huge good, but it's also arguably pretty anxiety-producing. You know, they call it the paradox of choice, that the more free choice you have, the more anxious you'll be about making those choices.
Perhaps almost finally, Scott, when you come to the middle of the book, there's a bit where you meet the doctor who treated you when you were 10 years old, and his parting words to you are, "You're not doomed." But you quite quickly jump into the next sentence, which I think is talking about the fact that, you know, in a way, you want to kind of, you don't want to recover from this anxiety. You kind of almost want to accept it. After writing all this book and all the things that you've been through, where are you today?
Well, I would be thrilled if I were to be fully cured of my anxiety. I think I would, you know, wake up in the morning with a greater bounce in my step and a lightness in my heart. But no, I mean, it was a great consolation to me to, you know, first of all, learn about all the people who have suffered from this affliction over the years, including some really, eminent people. The book is out here in the United States, and the response I've been has been remarkably heartening, just hearing from fellow sufferers who talk about how reading the book helped them recognize that they weren't alone and gave them insight. So, I mean, the jury is still out. And I do recognize, you know, I talk a lot about the difference between genes and environment, and I think there's a strong genetic component to one's predisposition to a level of anxiety, but experience and, you know, developing, learning how to cultivate resilience can be enormously important in reducing anxiety and just making yourself a stronger person.
I've got one final question for both of you. What did one maths exam say to the other maths exam? I've got a lot of problems. Scott Stossel, thank you so much for joining us on The Weekly. That was Scott Stossel, editor of The Atlantic and author of My Age of Anxiety.
Up next, we'll indulge in some fashion chatter as London Collections Men comes to a close. Stay tuned.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly, and it's that time of the year again. London Collections Men has just finished, and all eyes are now on Milan for Men's Fashion Week there. So today, to celebrate masculine chic, we thought we'd take a look at what makes a great suit.
That's the theme of the latest exhibition at the Museum of London, The Anatomy of a Suit, organised in conjunction with London's Men's Fashion Week. The show looks back at the history of great suits and dissects the best examples of fine tailoring in the British capital. And to find out more, we're joined now by Timothy Long, fashion curator at the Museum of London. And I must say, a gentleman who's turned up in a very fine suit as well. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And now tell me, the exhibition is about the anatomy of a suit. And this sounds like you're looking at the what's behind the front piece, as it were, what goes into making a suit. Why are you kind of pulling apart suits to try and find out how they're made and what they do?
Well, as we saw on the runways of LCM, the suit and the suit jacket specifically is the most common piece that you'll find in menswear today. And I think the suit gets a lot of negative flack for being conformity, for being uncomfortable, for a whole list of things. To me, though, as a fashion historian, I find the suit to be a wonderful window into history if you know where to look and what type of clues to find. And so my goal as curator at the Museum of London is to support a growing citywide initiative to shine a spotlight on the menswear industry in London. It's become a $10 billion industry. It's going to eclipse the sales of a women's wear by 2016. So it's a very big topic that certainly has a contemporary spin. And the city is trying to establish London as the home of menswear, or the capital of menswear. And so we certainly are when you look at the contemporary numbers. But what I would like to do is highlight the rich history of London's contributions to menswear. And so the exhibition puts a spotlight on what we are about to begin. We are going to begin looking very closely within our collection at the Museum of London, which really holds one of the greatest collections of menswear. Unfortunately, though, a lot of the juicy tidbits about a suit are hidden on the inside. And so the tremendous collection of menswear that we have at the Museum of London, I cannot rip apart. I cannot show the interior because it's, of course, unethical.
You can just flash your lining, right?
Yes. And so I have been trying to figure out how to tell this story with trying to create a bit of a new way of looking at menswear, because I think menswear can, in exhibitions, be very boringly presented. I think often menswear exhibitions are done very poorly in the sense that it almost looks like you've walked into a department store. And what I would like to do is take the sort of very well-known suit and surprise people with what you can learn from looking at it. And so I've gone to Broadway Market, Brick Lane, various vintage places around London to buy counterparts of suits that we have in our collection. So an early 20th century morning coat, I've gone to a vintage shop to try and find, and I have found them, some of them for as little as 10 to 25 pounds, with the intention of cutting them apart specifically to teach myself more about the tailoring industry, but then also to use them as a way to show the visitors that come to the Museum of London. So putting out these pieces with the interior layers ripped back to try and highlight the simple fact that it's an industry that has produced this, and the suit, the ubiquitous suit, the reason it has become something that you see around the world is not just because of Western influence, but because it is a very good design. And at the core of the suit is a time-honored design that has been pioneered and perfected here in London for over 400 years. So looking at the craft of the industry that has produced it, other cities have had an influence, but no other city has had such a tremendous influence as London. And I'd like to highlight that through some of our research.
And in terms of the style of suit, narrow lapels, wide lapels, flares, not skinny, baggy, boxy. We think of maybe an American suit as being a different thing to a British one, an Italian one, etc. How much have suits reacted to fashion, reacted against them, or led fashion, if you like, broader, maybe high street fashion rather than sort of catwalk fashion?
I've always said that clothing is a register of social change. Sometimes I think it's a bit, perhaps people think it's easier to read that in women's clothing, the hemline history, if you will. Yeah. Hemlines go up, they go down. You can understand the economic situation of a country by looking at women's hemlines, they say. Menswear has often been overlooked, I think, simply because you have people saying the great male renunciation, various things, menswear is boring, there's nothing to learn about. And so menswear, just like womenswear, if you know where to look, has those exact responses to cultural change. Yes, the lapel widens and thins, but there are other ways of looking at those cultural changes just by looking at some of the import, the export. Going back 400 to 500 years, which is where I'm beginning my research, which is where I believe tailoring was born.
Tights. Come on. It's all going to say tights here.
I
miss
my
those days, don't you, Andrew?
But looking at, like, for example, you have a lot of information written about the beginnings of global trade in the 16th century. A suit can highlight that global trade beautifully. For example, we have some tremendous 16th century jackets in our collection, and those jackets are made from a whole source of materials. You have wool, silk, linen, cotton, pineapple cloth, bark cloth, different types of coconut cloth, silver, gold, and in the 16th century, a majority of that material was not born, if you will, in England. And so if you look at these suits, you can see a tremendous history of import and exports, influence from England and other countries. King Charles II, of course, introducing the waistcoat in 1666. If you know where to look, you can see a great deal of social change being recorded in the evolution of a suit.
Tell me, when you look at the modern suit, are there lots of bits of lineage that go back hundreds of years? You know, I've always been told that, you know, the vent on the back is, you know, when a gentleman got on a horse, you know, you didn't want your jacket kind of tight around your backside. You know, the buttons, you know, why do we keep those four buttons or three buttons on our cuffs when I say yours do work, but on most people's jackets they no longer work, they're just there for decoration. You know, where, you know, the way that they button, you know, the side they button, all those things are, all those things, they have heritage going back hundreds of years.
Absolutely. And that's my goal, is to, in trying to identify specifically what London's role has been, is to look at the origins of that. And so in my research, I'm trying to identify the very beginnings of when you see horse canvas lining put in the inside of a jacket. Some of the images I have here show various approaches to how a suit is made. If you rip out the exterior layer, as in the exhibition, which we've done, you can see various materials on the inside. And I'm trying to reach back as far as I can, 300, 400, 500, 600, 700, 800 years in the past, to see when that craft was starting to be introduced, to try and illustrate this story.
I love the idea of that. I love the fact that it all has such a lineage, and especially, as you say, the kind of the trade routes being illustrated in the sort of materials used for the suit. What about, we have an idea maybe now, we talk about Savile Row sometimes on this show, and obviously in the pages of the magazine, as being sort of proper tailoring. But what about sort of very important sort of names, certainly in British high street fashion, like Burton, for example, who presumably made the suit cheaper originally in the sort of 30s and 50s. How important are they to you, the sort of high street stuff, the cheaper end of things?
Absolutely important. I recently bought a suit from Top Man specifically to take apart. Yeah. It was £15 on the sale rack. It was a very small size. And I think they're ready-to-wear certainly can get a great deal of negative press. You know, we could spend a lot of time talking about that. But I think what is so beautifully highlighted in that level of you know, high street compared to Savile Row is the fact that the 300, 400, 500 years that have been perfected in menswear here has given us the ability to make a suit in ready-to-wear. Mm-hmm. So if you take apart a high street suit, seldom are you going to find any sewing on the interior layer. It's all glued together, and it's all plastic on the interior. It's no shock to anyone that the interior is not a handmade, you know, if you're spending £15, it's not handmade. But all of those hundreds of years of perfecting that suit has given us the ability to produce something so mass-produced. The techniques have been worked out in a way that give us the ability to make a suit that fits a second skin. You put it on, even if it's £15. It might not fit perfectly, or it might not do exactly what a Savile Row suit might do, but that suit is made based on those traditions that have been developed over hundreds of years.
It must be a bit Glenn Close in your office, you with your scissors cutting up everyone's suit jackets when they're not looking.
I see, you know, a few of my office mates pulling away when I see something really interesting on the suit.
I wonder if the suit has also survived just because I know that you're talking here about the engineering, but it's interesting to see when a guy who doesn't normally wear a suit puts on a suit. We had our Christmas party, you know, you can wear whatever you really want, I guess, at Monocle. But, you know, there at the Christmas party, there's, you know, 100 guys suddenly in a suit. And people stand up in a different way. Their movements are slightly different. A suit is oddly very flattering, you know, whatever your kind of build and shape, if you choose the right one. Is there something in that as well, you think, that's the survival of the suit, that it's just weird, it's transformative power when it's done
absolutely. Well? Absolutely. I think the transformative power is absolutely essential in it becoming something that is worn around the world. I think the fact that it is designed well is part of that. But I think also, probably more than anything, it's very democratic. It provides an even playing field, especially during the beginning, the era of the beginning of the businessman, the early part of the 19th century. You have the suit becoming popular because there needed to be that even playing field. Instead of the lords and those with a great deal of money, we're not making the decisions anymore. It was the businessman around a table. And if you look fabulous in your sort of theatrical ensemble, you're not considered to be an appropriate businessman. You're not considered to be sober and serious. And so the suit provides that even playing field where if you have a specific silhouette, I may be 5-10 pounds bigger than you or 50 pounds bigger than you, those peculiarities of our body are covered up and we are all in an even playing field when it comes to business, which is why it is so successful. That individuality can be looked at as sort of negative, that it's no longer there, but it does create an even playing field that I think is part of its success.
On that engineering front, I was with somebody when they went to be measured for a suit for the first time to have a suit made, and the guy doing the measuring said, sorry, so do you know your right shoulder is almost a centimeter lower than your left shoulder? And he thought, oh, well, I'll go and get my back looked at. And it turned out he had a back problem. And it was all just came from the preciseness of, you know, there's no machine. It's just literally a guy looking at you. But he knew exactly how the body was made. And so when he was making a suit, it was precision engineering.
And he went, and he couldn't afford the suit then. He went and spent £2,000 in a chiropractor.
Got a suit from when he put the back brace on, the suit, the jacket no longer fitted.
But then the tailor can fix those problems.
Yes.
The tailor just adds that extra centimeter in padding on your shoulder and provides you with the silhouette that you don't have. Women put on garments to tweak their body in order to make their silhouette appropriate. We don't do that. Men won't do that. We have that on the inside layers of our suit. It does transform our body. The rolls and folds, the indentions of our shoulder piece, those are covered up by the suit. What we present, the silhouette we present when a suit on is not a natural silhouette, and that is something that's simply covered up on the interior layers of the suit.
That's fascinating. I love all that. And I love the stuff about it sort of imposing a seriousness of purpose or a unity of purpose on a group of people wearing it. Like I'm always amazed looking at political leaders from pretty much every country in the world, North America, South America, all across, the Japanese Prime Minister, the Chinese President all wear suits.
But that's fairly recent.
It's a funny, exactly, but that didn't used to be the case, did it?
Yeah, absolutely. Years ago, not maybe even 5-10 years ago, you still had individuals and that photo of the world leaders. They would still wear, some of them would still wear their national dress or dress that identified with their country. And so that no longer exists. And that's only over the last 5 or 10 years where those photos now, I believe there was one person left over on the last photo.
It's
last
Hamid
year.
Karzai from Afghanistan always wears his national dress.
Exactly. Everyone else is in the same suit.
But they're obviously differing qualities.
Even
Timothy Long is rolling his eyes. The same old suit, he says.
Let me cut it apart.
Says the fashion curator of the Museum of London. It's fascinating stuff. I didn't mean to do it. Oh, dear, what have I done? And it would be nice to know a tiny bit about you before we go, Timothy. Are you a tailor by trade or are you a historian by trade?
I was trained as a tailor, actually, and then I got my degree as a historian. So there is a long history of tailoring in my family. I'm from Chicago originally. There were tailors in Chicago, my family there. I was raised around a grandmother who sewed a great deal and was taught some sewing very early on. I went into tailoring school, actually, thinking I wanted to be a tailor. But then I realized my interests weren't in the production of it. It was in the history part. And so I went to graduate school for fashion history, actually history and culture of fashion. But I've learned that as a historian that focuses on fashion history, the knowledge of construction, I think, has really made my approach unique, where most fashion historians do not know construction, just like most painting historians don't know how to paint. Mm. And so I think it gives you a little bit of an edge when you understand, when you're reading and curating subjects about construction, which is specifically my interest. It helps a great deal to have a hat in both worlds of the construction and history.
We're also going to enter you in our Best Bearded Guest Award as well.
Oh, excellent. Yes. Thank you.
I think
I waxed it just for you today.
There we go. we've had some very good beards. We had the gin gentleman just before Christmas.
Yeah.
The fine beard.
And a guy Tim might know, Patrick Grant, always carrying a healthy beard.
Yeah, he came in here with a very good beard.
Excellent.
Timothy Long, fashion curator of the Museum of London, thank you so much for joining us. And The Anatomy of a Suit, the exhibition, is on until the 1st of June at the Sackler Hall at the Museum of London. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, Andrew, that was one Monocle Weekly down for 2014. How many to go? 51.
51.
Although they might get the number wrong. You never know, do you, with this? You never know which one we're doing. We've done quite a few. It's easy to lose count. That was the 236th edition of the Monocle Weekly.
And we talked about a lot of interesting things today. We talked about ethics. Do you know what ethics are? Well, do you know what ethics is, rather?
I know what ethics are.
Do you know what ethics is?
Yeah, it's just north of Suffolk.
Oh!
Hey!
He stole my joke!
Was that what
oh, no!
I didn't literally know.
He said, like Fozzie Bear.
Waka, waka, waka.
Anyway, we...
Oh, I've been saving that joke.
Really?
I've been saving that joke for an hour.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I thought you were making a moral judgment about my ethical stance on most things and people and saying, Rob, you don't even know how to spell ethics. And I was going to go, yes, I do, E-double-S-E-X.
Okay, we've both got the same Book of Armada jokes, I think.
Yeah, exactly. That was a Christmas cracker joke, wasn't it?
Yes.
Essentially.
Well,
I liked all our guests. I thought Timothy Long, good beard-wearing fashion guy, he was very good, wasn't he?
He was very good.
I like Catherine Neal. I like the idea. I think business ethics is an interesting thing to possibly explore in a story at some point in a Monocle supplement, possibly, or in the business section. I think that's quite interesting, isn't
it? Yeah, and it's interesting that she has kind of warmed up to a gentleman who may be innocent, but whose business ethics are probably... thinner than some other people's. That was carefully said.
That was very carefully said. Keep the lawyers out of episode 236 of the Monocle Weekly, Andrew. Why don't you?
Okay.
So it's all good.
Yeah.
And our mate from The Atlantic, always a pleasure having someone like that on as well, right?
Yeah, and Tom Edwards is fine form as well.
Well, we've ticked everyone off the list. All it remains is to thank our producer, Daphne Denis, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond, and ourselves, possibly, and our listeners for tuning in. So from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.